welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, November 29th, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a courthouse steps decision telephone on Weyerhaeuser versus United States Fish and Wildlife Service. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mark Miller, who is Senior Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation. After our expert gives his remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Mark, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Micah. Good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to those of you listening on the West Coast. My name is Mark Miller. I'm a senior attorney with Pacific Legal Foundation, and Micah and Federal Society asked me to do a teleform on the case Weyerhaeuser versus U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which was a decision, a unanimous decision of the U.S. Supreme Court reached earlier this week. Pacific Legal Foundation's involvement with the case is that the case involves a dispute between a number of landowners in Louisiana and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in an Endangered Species Act case. And Pacific Legal Foundation has been representing most of the landowners in the case from the beginning of the case, with Weyerhaeuser Company being the one of the landowners we do not represent. So the case is known as Weyerhaeuser, but we represent the other landowners. I was just reading Rick Brookhiser's biography of Chief Justice John Marshall, and when Brookhiser describes some cases in the book, he prefaces by saying that every legal case could be a short story. And so this case, I think, has gone on for so long it could actually be a novel. But at bottom, what the case is about your property rights, the client's ability, the property owner's ability to use their property free of unreasonable or legal interference with his property rights and his ability to use his property. So here, what you have is a family. Edward Poitevant and his family have owned several thousand acres of timberland in Louisiana, in St. Tammany Parish, which, for those of you who know Louisiana, St. Tammany Parish is on the far side of the Lake Pontchartrain Bridge. And so St. Tammany is effectively a suburb from New Orleans, so the far side of Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans. And so St. Tammany, where Edward Poitevant's family has owned land for more than 100 years, is over the years becoming suburbia for New Orleans. But going back to when they first owned the property, it was, as I said, timberland. It's been a tree farm. The family has used the property since Reconstruction, and they had a mill years ago during the Depression. They almost lost the property because of the Depression, but they were able to maintain ownership of the several thousand acres, and now they lease the property. They entered a lease in the 1950s, and the lessee now is the Weyerhaeuser Company. And so they've been the landlord of this property. They've owned the property for all these decades, really over a century. And in the early 2000s, unbeknownst to them, a frog was going to come into their lives. And it was at the time was known as the Mississippi gopher frog. The Mississippi gopher frog, pursuant to the terms of the Endangered Species Act, was declared an endangered species by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2001. And according to the Endangered Species Act, federal government has to designate critical habitat, property that would be habitat and also critical and essential, if you will, for that species to be conserved, to be brought back. And so initially, Fish and Wildlife Service did not make that designation, but ultimately by 2010, they had a proposed designation for the Mississippi gopher frog. And not surprisingly, since it was known as the Mississippi gopher frog, the designations of the critical habitats, so the land that would be set aside for this frog, was going to be in Mississippi. But a biologist and some naturalists did not think that was enough land to support the Mississippi gopher frog, and they actually then pointed to land in Louisiana, which just turns out to sit on the acreage that our clients own, Edward Poitevant and his family, and Weyerhaeuser Company, as a lessee, also owns a small piece of it. And the historical biologist said, this land over here in St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana, could be backup habitat for the frog, because decades and decades ago, within the historical range of the frog, this frog would have been seen or heard, would have croaked in Louisiana, if you will. And so Fish and Wildlife Service took that direction and decided to declare what has become known as Unit 1 of the designations. Unit 1 of the critical habitat designation for the frog is our client's property, 1,544 acres, of which our client owns the vast majority of it, Edward Poitevin and his family. And what that means is that designation means, in theory, is that the frog, if it was put there, you would think, since it's critical to, and its habitat, if you put the frog there, it would come back, you know, and get away from being endangered, no differently than the bald eagle or any other species that has been brought back through the Endangered Species Act. But in fact, the problem in this case is that designating this land as critical habitat does not help the frog, because the frog could not live on the land. Not only does the frog not live there, but if you put it there, it couldn't survive. And that's according to the government itself. The Fish and Wildlife Service says you need three essential features in the land, primary constituent elements for the frog to survive. And we only have, at most, in this case, one of them, that being ponds. It needs ephemeral ponds to breed, and then it needs upland habitat, and it needs an open canopy forest. Well, we may have the ponds on the property for purposes of the case, that's accepted, but you don't have an upland habitat, and you don't have an open canopy forest. As I said earlier, this is a tree farm, and it's actually a loblolly closed canopy forest. You can't have a closed canopy forest with these frogs, because if you do, the frog's predators are going to swoop down and eat it, which would not help conserve it. So you'd have to effectively terraform this land to change it dramatically to make it habitat for the frog. And so that's really been what the landowner was saying. When the landowner learned in between 2010 and 2012, when the final designation was made that included the Poitevin property in Louisiana, when he learns about the frog, he says, well, there's no frogs here. We don't know anything about frogs. But the government goes forward anyway, and that's when Pacific Legal is brought in, and we challenge the designation, and we say that, we say any number of things, but ultimately, as it worked its way through the courts, the fight became about whether you could designate land as critical habitat for an endangered species when that land would not support the species at all. So was it essential to the frog's survivability here? Or was it habitat, if you will? And then secondly, the case also developed into an interesting administrative law question, which is when Fish and Wildlife Service decided this property was going to be critical habitat for the frog, according to the ESA itself, it had to weigh the economic impact that the designation would have on the landowners and weigh that against any sort of benefit to the frog, to the species. And here, the government could not put together and show any quantifiable benefit to the frog, which is really not surprising because, as I said, the frog couldn't survive there unless you dramatically changed the property. Yet the government did have to admit there was a significant economic loss to the property owners. If you set aside, and so let's say the property owners want to develop, which, as I was alluding to earlier, this area, St. Tammany Parish, is suburbia for New Orleans. And so even though it's a tree farm now, ultimately the landowners intend to develop the land and already have a plan in place with St. Tammany Parish, which is the local county government, and the state to develop this land. But if they're not going to be allowed, so if they're going to have to pull permits with the federal government, say a wetlands permit, a Clean Water Act permit, then under the ESA Section 7, before the government could approve that, it would have to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service regarding the frog. And so let's say the Fish and Wildlife Service were to say, well, no, to protect the frog, you've got to set aside 60% of the property for the frog. Well, the government admits that would be a $20 million loss in value to the landowners. And then if you set aside the entire property for the frog, which is effectively what Fish and Wildlife Service would intend to do, if you look at this practically speaking, then you're looking at a $34 million loss. And I want to emphasize, when I say a $34 million loss, that's not our number. That's not the property owner's number. That's not warehouse or company's number. That's the federal government's estimate. And so Fish and Wildlife Service says, even in the face of a $34 million loss in development value to the landowners, and no real quantifiable benefit to the frog, we're still going to go ahead and include Unit 1, include the landowner's land in Louisiana, in the critical habitat designation for the frog. Well, until now, until the decision a few days ago, you could not challenge that weighing by the Fish and Wildlife Service, that decision not to exclude the habitat. The courts have been saying that decision was within the discretion of the agency head, and that you that a landowner, for example, in this case, our client, Edward Poitevant, his family, and our Weyerhaeuser company, they couldn't even sue over that decision. That was simply entirely within the discretion of the agency. So that sort of gets us to where we are this week. So the case was then argued October 1st. Tim Bishop, a lawyer with Mayor Brown, argued the case on behalf of Weyerhaeuser. The landowners were there too. We were all part of the briefing. Beyond the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the family landowners who Pacific Legal represents, and, of course, Weyerhaeuser, we also had the Center for Biological Diversity as an intervener. And so the Supreme Court heard the case on the first day of the new term, so it was heard by 8 justices. It was the first argument of the new term. Justice Kavanaugh had not been confirmed as of yet. And the oral argument was interesting in the sense that it was the first day, and the court was sort of feeling its way, if you will. The justices were sort of feeling their way as to how they were going to decide this case. And so just this week, we got a decision when, coming out of the oral argument, it was hard to tell where the court was going to go. The second question that I've alluded to, which is an administrative law question about when you can sue over an agency decision under the Administrative Procedure Act, any number of followers of the court's jurisprudence thought that that was sort of an easier question for the Supreme Court, that they might overturn that decision of the lower court, and that had been uniformly decided in other circuits as well, that you couldn't challenge that economic the decision not to exclude the property despite the economic impact and the lack of quantifiable benefits under the ESA. Any number of us thought that that was a way the court could resolve the case, but send it back down to the lower court and tell the court to make that decision under the APA to decide if that was an arbitrary and capricious decision not to exclude the property. But the other question, though, the first question, which really got a lot of media attention for the case, was about habitat for the endangered species. Some people tried to make the case to be about the Endangered Species Act in general, and can you protect endangered species? And really, that's not what the case is about. I think everyone involved with the case would say, of course you need to protect endangered species, but you have to do it, number one, pursuant to the law, and number two, in a way that will actually conserve, bring back the species from the brink of extinction. And here, of course, this designation doesn't do that because the frog can't live there. And so Chief Justice Roberts was very active at the oral argument. Sort of tease out the government argument. I think I can give an example of one of the questions he argued, and that sort of gets to the heart of what the case was about, which is this. If the land of Louisiana only has one of 3 characteristics that are essential for the frog to survive and be conserved, be brought back, then, and the government can call that habitat and critical habitat for the frog, even though the frog couldn't live there, then why couldn't the government also then designate property in Alaska critical habitat for this frog, put up some sort of geodome and retrofit that land and invest whatever millions of dollars you would need for the frog in Alaska and call that habitat for the frog? And the government lawyer, Ed Needler, for the Solicitor General's office, didn't really have an answer for that question at all. And so I think that was sort of a foreshadowing of the opinion we got this week, because it was Chief Justice Roberts who wrote the opinion. And what he did in large part was he crafted a unanimous opinion, which has been portrayed to some extent as a limited win for the landowners, but I would proffer was actually a pretty big win, because if you look at where they were the day before the opinion came out, they were looking at the inability to use the land going forward other than as a tree farm, and that once the tree farm was exhausted, once the trees were exhausted, they wouldn't have been able to do anything because they would have been subject to the government's decision-making when they would need to pull a permit, and the government had already, you know, sort of cast its lot and said this land is needed for a frog. And I should say as a tangent, and this doesn't get a lot of play in the opinion or any play at all, but there is a different way that the federal government could go about protecting the frog under the ESA, under the Endangered Species Act, that would have been valid and still would be valid, which is to simply buy the land. Under the ESA Section 5, the government could make an offer or, you know, even reach an agreement or even take it by eminent domain and pay just compensation. If the government thinks it's so important that it's a public use for this land to protect the frog, the government could buy the land and create the frog habitat that it wants to put there, and then you couldn't argue with it. But instead, the government used a different tool, a tool that really has no applicability on these facts, because this land is not habitat for the frog at all. The frog can't survive there. Now, Chief Justice Roberts didn't say that in the opinion in so many words. Instead, he said the lower court didn't really address whether this land is habitat, let alone critical habitat, for the frog. And so the court unanimously remanded the case back to the lower court to decide in the first instance whether this land is habitat for the frog at all. He makes an interesting one of the later moments. There's a couple of sort of later moments in the opinion. The second one is which he gives a sort of grammar lesson, where he says when we're talking about critical habitat, he says, according to the ordinary understanding of how adjectives work, critical habitat must also be habitat. Adjectives modify nouns. They take out a subset of a category that possesses a certain quality. I was happy, having been on this case, to then share that little paragraph with my wife, who is a high school English teacher, and she appreciated Chief Justice Roberts' point there. And so Roberts was saying, you can't call land here, Unit 1, Louisiana land, our client's land, critical habitat unless it's habitat in the first instance. And he said the lower court didn't really pass on that. And so not to get too deep into the weeds into what happened in the lower court, but really, I think although he doesn't cite this opinion, Edith Jones of the Fifth Circuit had dissented from the denial of rehearing in bank of the case on behalf of six judges of the Fifth Circuit. And she made this very point that Chief Justice Roberts is making here. Of course, she answered the question in the dissent. And she said, in fact, critical habitat has to be a subset of habitat. And if a creature can't survive on a piece of property without dramatic change to the property, then it can't be habitat, let alone critical habitat. And what she did, and I'm not a mathematician, but I did appreciate this, is she created a couple of Venn diagrams and in the opinion. And in one of the Venn diagrams, she shows how there's all land, then there's going to be habitat for species within, you know, it's the first circle, and then within that circle, there's going to be critical habitat. That's what the ESA sets out, as she shows. But instead, what she said the Fish and Wildlife Service was doing or had done was they created a Venn diagram where you had all land, then you had one circle of habitat under the ESA, and then you had a second circle that didn't overlap with the first circle at all that was critical habitat. And it sort of really, by using picture paints, you know, a picture with 1,000 words, so she has two pictures, 2,000 words, she really cuts to the heart of the matter, and I would respectfully suggest that that's really what Chief Justice Roberts is doing here. He's following Judge Jones's lead. So on the first question, then, of whether this is habitat, whether this can be critical habitat for the frog, Chief Justice Roberts, on behalf of the unanimous court, vacated the lower court decision and said, try again. And then on the second question, which is an administrative law question, this question of can you challenge the agency head when the agency decides not to exclude property from a critical habitat designation, is that even reviewable in court under the APA? And again, we get a unanimous opinion, which is, as I said earlier, that was the second question of the case. That was a question that I think any number of followers thought was a little bit of an easier question, which of course then makes anyone wonder why the lower courts couldn't get it right. I don't know, but at Pacific Legal Foundation, we've had some degree of success in opening the courthouse doors in cases like this. In a case a couple of years ago called Hawks, which was a Clean Water Act case, and another case called Sackett, litigated by Damian Schiff of Pacific Legal Foundation. Both cases, the government, in one of them the EPA and the other the Corps of Engineers, the federal agency said, you can't challenge our decision. And on behalf of our clients, we specifically said, yes, we can. And in both cases, unanimous cases, Sackett and Hawks, the Supreme Court said, yes, indeed, the property owners are right, the Pacific Legal's right, you can sue about this. So it doesn't answer the question on the merits as to whether what the government was doing in those cases was right, but it is to say that the courthouse doors are open to Americans to challenge the government when the government does something that affects their property rights. And so this case, it's sort of nice to see, is another unanimous decision, not just on the question of vacating the decision on the habitat finding, but also on the administrative law question, which is, you know, when can you sue? And some have already theorized that that second part of the opinion will become a broader decision. So not just an environmental question, not just an Endangered Species Act case, but also just an administrative law case that goes, that becomes cited more widely. What else? So before I open the door to questions, I will point out one other, for those of the real appellate opinion lovers who like, you know, cute turns of phrase, things like that. You know, Chief Justice Roberts is famous when he was in private practice for opening his briefs with something to sort of humanize the case so that the judges or the justices reviewing the brief could, you know, find a handle into it. And so here, Chief Justice Roberts sort of harkens back to that, the way he likes to do that when he describes the frog. I said, I don't think I ever tied this up. This was originally known as the Mississippi gopher frog because it was in Mississippi. But now, of course, at the Supreme Court, it's known as the dusky gopher frog. I would posit, although who knows why the government makes any decision it makes. But here, it went from the Mississippi gopher frog in 2001 when it was declared endangered to the dusky gopher frog in 2012. The name was actually changed by rule. I would suggest that change may have been made because they, at the same time that the change was made, or about the same time, they then designated land in Louisiana for the frog. And so I guess they could have changed the name to the Mississippi and Louisiana gopher frog, but instead it became the dusky gopher frog. But anyway, back to Roberts. So Chief Justice Roberts describes the frog and says, the frog is noted for covering its eyes with its front legs when it feels threatened, peeking out periodically until danger passes. And then less endearingly, it also secretes a bitter, milky substance to deter would-be diners. So he just, that's his opening paragraph of the opinion describing, or opening paragraph of section 1A of the opinion, where he's sort of trying to, I guess, in this sense, I can't remember the literary term I'm looking for, he's sort of personifying the frog, if you will. He's trying to get a handle on what this frog is about. So the case, though, really is not about a frog. It's about private property rights, and the court unanimously came down on the side of making sure private property rights are protected in a fair way, and he remanded this, the court remanded the case back for the Fifth Circuit to consider, is this habitat at all? And then if it is habitat, then I think the second question would be, was it arbitrary and capricious or an abuse of discretion for the government not to exclude the property when, you know, not only was there this $34 million potential loss in value, but also what wasn't even considered by the Fish and Wildlife Service is the amount of money it would cost to terraform the land to make it proper living conditions to make it a habitat for the frog. Because as I said, you need the upland breeding habitat, you need ephemeral ponds, you need open canopy forest, so you have to clear from 1,500 acres, which is double the size of, say, Central Park. You're going to have to clear all those closed canopy loblolly trees and plant pine trees in an open canopy. And you're also going to need frequent fires, I should mention, because fires have to clear out the underbrush because the frog needs to be able to eat. And the underbrush, if it goes up too much, will take away from its living conditions down there on the ground. And so you'd have constant fires in what's going to become suburbia, which is really not a good idea. And that's why the local government supported us and the state government with an amicus brief. And you would need an entirely different land mass in Louisiana to support the fraud. And so, you know, you never know what will happen in the courts as the case progresses, but we are certainly very happy with this result at the Supreme Court, and we look forward to the case going down to the Fifth Circuit to continue the litigation. And so with that, I will be happy to take any questions, Micah.
Thank you, Mark, for those remarks. And not seeing any immediate questions lining up. Mark, did you want to tell us what you think is going to happen in the Fifth Circuit here on remand?
You know, it's interesting because it's been a few years since the original decision, and then there was a motion for a hearing in bank that pended for a year. And so there's been, you know, some changes in the Fifth Circuit in the couple of years since the original opinion and then the denial of the rehearing in bank. The denial of the rehearing in bank, I should mention the original lower court decision was 2-1 with Judge Owen writing a dissent, and then the rehearing in bank was an 8-6 decision. With, as I said, Judge Jones, Edith Jones, writing the dissent on behalf of the Sixth. So now, in the lower court, it's back at the Fifth Circuit, and I should note that Chief Justice Roberts was very explicit in the opinion for the court in saying he wants the Fifth Circuit to address this. The court wants the Fifth Circuit to address this in the first instance. Oftentimes, you know, if you read opinions carefully, the court doesn't necessarily say that. And so you'll see the circuit court remand that first instance question to be resolved in the district court. And so at a minimum, we can reasonably expect that the Fifth Circuit will be hearing it, which is, I think, good for the landowners in the case who are hoping to see some sort of finality. It means this process hopefully is a little bit closer to an end now. And then I think you're going to see a real focus, as I was saying, you know, on what is habitat, and that Venn diagram that I mentioned, that Judge Owens, the two Venn diagrams, that, you know, how can you have critical habitat if it's not habitat? If the frog can't live there unless you make change. And Center for Biological Diversity wanted to say, well, it's reasonable change. But in fact, in the lower courts, I would respectfully suggest, it was accepted that you would need a significant change to the property. And so it was only at the U.S. Supreme Court level with the briefing where Fish and Wildlife Service and then CBD, tried to moderate and tweak what had been sort of accepted below, which was you don't have the primary constituent elements, two of the three. The three basic things you need for this frog to survive, you don't have two of the three. And that seemed to be fairly accepted, and it would take significant change. But then when we got to the Supreme Court, I would suggest, and I don't fault them, you want to present your best case that you can, but they sort of tweaked their presentation, and all of a sudden it became, well, it would just be some moderate change. And that was, I think, a smart play on their part, because Justice Kagan, in the oral argument, picked up on it, and she tried to create, in her questions, in her hypotheticals, to Tim Bishop, who was arguing on behalf of Weyerhaeuser, this, you know, how much of a change to land do you need to take it from habitat to non-habitat? So, for example, if this land had two of the three constituent elements, would that make it habitat? And then, of course, there are other cases in this critical habitat designation land of case law where you might have two pieces of property where either one of the two pieces of property that are adjacent to each other, one has some of the constituent elements and the other piece of land has the other constituent elements. So you put those two pieces of land together, and together they create all of the necessary elements to create a habitat. But you take either piece separate and you don't have that. But here, and so you can at least see the logic there where the two pieces of land sort of work together. But here you don't have that. Here you have a piece of property 70 miles away from the nearest actual habitat, occupied habitat, if you will, under the statute, when the statute talks about occupied and unoccupied habitat. And this land is, in fact, being designated, the government said, in case of catastrophe. If there's some catastrophe in Mississippi, then you could use this land in Louisiana as backstop habitat for the frog.
Well, I guess that must have triggered a lot of questions from the audience, because now we have quite a few lined up. So without further ado, let's go to our first audience question.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. It sounds like the government's definition of habitat was not met, and yet the government pursued the case. Am I wrong? I mean, if the land didn't qualify as habitat under the government's definition, why did the Trump administration pursue the case to the Supreme Court?
Why the administration pursued the case at the Supreme Court is certainly a good question. I think, trying to put myself in their head, they'd had a win at the lower courts, and they wanted to defend the win. And so I think that would explain why they then took it. It was, as you're picking up, this was an Obama administration rule and designation, but the Trump administration continued with it. And so they then, you know, sort of adjusted their sails at the Supreme Court. As I said, initially, they would, in the lower courts, they took the position that critical habitat didn't have to be habitat at all, and that's what then prompts Chief Justice Roberts to do his grammar lesson. But of course, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's lawyers, or the Solicitor General's office, I suppose, the DOJ and the Solicitor General's office, recognized that opinion didn't hold water. That argument was not going to hold water, and so they trimmed their sails and said, "No, we concede now that critical habitat does have to be habitat." Center for Biological Diversity did not concede that point, but at the Supreme Court, they conceded that point. I certainly don't know why Roberts and the court didn't reach a decision with finality. Although you could say, you could speculate, I think reasonably speculate, that there's some value, as Chief Justice Roberts sees it, to a unanimous decision. So if he is following Judge Jones's dissent, where the fight in the Fifth Circuit to a large extent had been about whether land that is not habitable to a species can be essential to the species, which gets at the statutory definition of an unoccupied critical habitat. And then Judge Jones took the case in a little bit of a different direction, and then Chief Justice Roberts, writing on behalf of the entire court, follows Judge Jones's lead and then says, "I want the Fifth Circuit now to address that argument on the merits." I think he was able to win a unanimous decision with that decision, angle on the opinion. And so I don't know if that's what he was up to, but certainly it certainly is consistent with what Chief Justice Roberts has talked about and what, you know, any, as I said, I was reading Brookhiser's biography of Marshall, and Chief Justice Marshall was very focused on bringing in unanimous decisions of the high court to try and demonstrate that the court was not about politics. It was, you know, that the court was about law, and that there is some abstract concept of law, and that this is not about power. And so you could see that if Roberts could bring a unanimous verdict this way, I'm not saying that's what he was doing, but that might have been why he pursued it this way. And so what the federal government will do now is anyone's guess, but at the same time, they did have a win. They did lose at the U.S. Supreme Court, but all was not lost yet for them. So, you know, it will be interesting to see what the federal government does. I can certainly predict to an extent what I expect the Fifth Circuit to do in terms of procedurally, in terms of extra briefing and likely an oral argument, et cetera. But what the, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service, what the SG's office or the AG's office will do in terms of defending the designation now, I suppose maybe is anybody's guess.
Let's go to our next question.
Yeah, hi, this is Darren Bax from the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for the presentation. A little confused. So Justice Roberts kind of made the argument, as you said, that if this Louisiana land can be considered habitat, then property in Alaska can be considered habitat if you made certain improvements, et cetera. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out, what is the actual question that the Fifth Circuit is going to even be addressing? Are they, and what was the majority of that, what was the unanimous decision on? I mean, Justice Roberts has made his kind of statement on what he thinks, that he doesn't think that Louisiana land would be habitat. At least I would think that's what he's saying. So the question is, what is the Fifth Circuit actually really addressing then? And to what extent does the opinion in any way tie the hands of the Fifth Circuit in limiting what can actually be habitat?
Well, in terms of the question they're going to be considering, I'm just simply going to effectively read what the last paragraph of of that portion of the opinion where he says what he wants them to do. The Court of Appeals concluded that, quote, critical habitat, end quote, designations under the statute were not limited to areas that qualified as habitat. The court, therefore, had no occasion to interpret the term habitat in the ESA or to assess the service's administrative findings regarding Unit 1. Accordingly, we vacate the judgment below and remand to consider these questions in the first instance. So what he's doing is saying, look, Fifth Circuit, you said that critical habitat did not have to be habitat. Well, now I think I'm telling you it does. You know, that was the grammar lesson about critical habitat means habitat. It has to be part of habitat. Critical is modifying the habitat. And so now he wants them to consider in the first instance, because he said they didn't decide it, that if it has to be habitat under the statute, does this land qualify as habitat? So I think that's what he's doing. Now, whether he's tying their hands or not, I guess it depends on, you know, how the lower court interprets this, what some have called a short opinion. You know, in the interest of unanimity, he perhaps held back the cards as to what the court actually thinks. And when I say the court, you know, this opinion is an 8-justice opinion, but, you know, we now know that there's 9 justices on the court. And so there may be some reading of tea leaves that would go on there as well. I don't know. But I think that, you know, you can never predict what a lower court's going to do when they've had a decision vacated and remanded. But a decision that's been vacated and remanded and done unanimously by the high court, you would think there might be some reading between the lines there. Does that make sense, Darren?
Yep, thanks.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. This is Tamara Tenney. You mentioned that there was some applicability of this case outside of environmental law. I don't practice environmental law, but I'm interested in that. In particular, do you view the holding in this case as potentially narrowing the scope of those questions that might fall within the non-justiciable set of questions committed to agency discretion?
That is exactly what I think that second question sort of gets at is, and in fact, a lot of the briefing on behalf of the landowners that Pacific Legal did focused on that question of non-justiciability. The agency wanted to be that the courts can't even review because there's no way to weigh the agency head's decision not to exclude, because he may, under the statute, he may exclude land from the designation after the agency weighs the factors laid out in the statute, including the economic impact. And so the government was putting all their sort of muscle behind the word may. But since the agency may exclude, their position was that is entirely unreviewable. It's just entirely up to the discretion of the agency head. And, you know, we argued, and Weyerhaeuser argued as well, as the opinion says, Weyerhaeuser's claim is the familiar one in administrative law that the agency did not appropriately consider all the relevant factors that the statute sets forth to guide the agency in the exercise of its discretion. And then it goes on, this is the sort of claim the federal courts routinely assess when determining whether to set aside an agency decision as an abuse of discretion. And so because it's that sort of routine assessment that courts review for abuse of discretion or arbitrary and capriciousness under the APA, this is just another one of those. And he also earlier in the opinion points out this court has noted the tension between the prohibition of judicial review for actions committed to agency discretion and the command of 706 of the APA that courts set aside any agency action that's arbitrary and capricious or abuse of discretion under Heckler. And he says, you know, we have made clear, well, and I'm putting words in his mouth, to give effect to 706 and to honor the presumption of review, we have read the exceptions in 701 of the APA quite narrowly, which is the idea that decisions aren't reviewable, restricting it to those rare circumstances where the relevant statute is drawn so that a court would have no meaningful standard against which to judge the agency's exercise of discretion. And so this is another blow for sort of, you know, we call it, I think, in one piece that we've written since the decision, you know, sort of Chevron's nasty cousin, the idea that it's kind of a deference doctrine here, but it's even more than deference. It's sort of abdication that we're not even, the courts were not even willing to review agency decision-making at all. They weren't just deferring. They weren't even going to review it at all. True deference, you know, basically abdication. And here's Chief Justice Roberts on behalf of the unanimous court saying, no, this is reviewable. The courthouse doors are open. You can challenge it. And this part of the opinion, I would say, does not, you know, Darren had asked about whether the opinion tied the Fifth Circuit's hands in terms of what is habitat, and there may be some grist for that mill in that portion of the opinion. Here, I would say Chief Justice Roberts did not sort of impliedly put his hand on one side of the scales in terms of whether this was an abuse of discretion, other than in one portion of the opinion he notes on page 11 where Weyerhaeuser pointed out that the service had not fully accounted for the economic impact of designated Unit 1 because it didn't value what it would cost to make the property habitat for the frog. You know, the burning that I mentioned, the changing of the 1,500 acres to two central parks, if you will, New York central parks, from closed canopy forest to open canopy forest. They didn't calculate that at all. They just simply looked at what the loss in economic value was. And so Weyerhaeuser there was trying to not just say you should review it, but, and here's why, because it was arbitrary and capricious. Roberts didn't go too far down that part of the road, but certainly there's a little bit there. But so, yeah, back to your question. Yes, I think the second part is just this decision is just a straight admin law answer that is good for those who are affected by administrative agency decision-making that has consequences that they want to bring into court for judicial review.
Let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon. This is Warren Belmar with a question. It really is more of policy. Whatever the political or career decision makers' motivations were to start this proceeding, we have a new set of at least political appointees, if not career employees, at the Fish and Wildlife Service. What is the benefit of the Fish and Wildlife Service continuing to fight this issue? Or can they, as a policy decision, adopt where the court clearly was directing them to go and avoid the need for tying up the time of the Fifth Circuit and a district court?
I would punt on any policy questions and say the lawyers at DOJ and Fish and Wildlife would be better off answering that question. I will say, though, that the Wall Street Journal, in an opinion about the decision, I think it was yesterday, said they hoped the AG, the editors of the Wall Street Journal, said they hoped the AG would take the agency off of autopilot when it came to this bureaucratic decision. So what is the benefit? I guess you would have to ask them and whoever the new AG may be.
Thank you. Let's go to our next caller.
This is R.J. Smith with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And first off, I'd like to say three cheers and thanks to PLF for another very important victory. Congratulations.
Thank you, R.J.
And secondly, on the this extremely important decision on critical habitat must be actual habitat. And it seems to me, and I wonder if you've given any thought to it, that this might help slow down this gigantic push that we're seeing from both NIMS and Department of Interior and the environmental movement as a whole to begin to push for creation of potential habitat all over the country, largely driven by the changes in philosophy that came in the George W. Bush administration under Lynn Scarlett, that climate change has to be recognized as perhaps the new driving force for endangerment of species because their habitat changes and shifts faster than the species can shift. So we have to start looking to plan ahead to begin to find ways to protect or designate habitat that is not only unoccupied now, but it's not even habitat now. And they're increasingly making decisions on that, and they're doing the same, I guess, with the U.S. Forest Service and the Department of Interior on landscape-scale conservation programs. But it would seem to me that this should be able to be used, this definition from the court on habitat, to the starter brakes on all that. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
You know, I think Sub Rosa, underneath this case, you know, in terms of the explicit discussion, the Sub Rosa discussion, what's going on underneath, well, not being discussed, but what is going on underneath is, as you said, climate change. And I'm not taking a position on that climate change one way or the other, but what it is to say is that here, part of the designation of Unit 1 from the government's position was that if there's a catastrophe in Mississippi, the implied catastrophe would be climate change, would be some sort of weather event that would wipe out the frogs in Mississippi. And so while in 2010 they designated habitat in Mississippi where the frog lives, the idea is that 70 miles away, the government designates this other land, what's Unit 1, as backup habitat, backup if there's a catastrophe, which flows from what you're alluding to, I think, I would posit is what is going on. I don't know, but that is does seem to be what's going on underneath the surface. And so, in fact, that doesn't come out in the opinion. It's certainly not really in the briefings in any sort of explicit way. But what Chief Justice Roberts, I think, is saying is that if agencies want to do what you're describing, RJ, it's really Congress's job then to change the law. Because the law, what Roberts is saying in this opinion on behalf of the unanimous court, I think,
right,
is that the law doesn't allow that. The law doesn't allow the agencies to do that. The law requires habitat to actually mean what habitat means. And this is, you know, not to be too textualist, but, you know, habitat pretty much meant in the late 1970s when they created critical habitat in the statute, what it means now. And if you can't survive on a piece of land, well, then that's not habitable for you. And, you know, Mars is not habitable for us. And so here, I think, yes, I think you're exactly right. I think that this decision could be a way of saying agencies can't try and do things that the law does not allow. They have to work within the power that Congress has delegated to them. They can't just freelance to achieve whatever ends they think are necessary to achieve. They may be perfectly valid ends, but it's Congress's job to amend this law or create a new law that does what they're trying to do sub rosa. They can't just do it on their own. And I think that's where, you know, the push against the regulatory state is going. And so, yes, I think this opinion is a very good step in that direction.
Yeah, and your comment about they could designate habitat under the decision that was used in this earlier on this by the lower courts, that they could easily designate land in Alaska. I mean, you can see the same thing. The CBD could call for designating parts of the Arizona desert as habitat for the endangered green sea turtle because the Gulf of California is only 50 miles away, and climate change is going to cause sea level to rise, you know, 200 feet or something like that. I mean, there's no stop to that if they just start guessing what habitat will be like 50 years from now or 100 years from now.
Yeah, and RJ, I'll just follow up. I wouldn't want to put words in their mouth, but I think that I've, you know, I was on a panel with a lawyer from Defenders of Wildlife after the decision, and we spoke on the panel about this, what you're getting at, this idea of when Chief Justice Roberts asked about the difference between Alaska and Louisiana, and basically asked for a limiting principle on what is habitat, how far can you go with habitat, and he and I discussed whether, you know, there is a limit, and his position was no, there can't be. And if I understood him right, his position was that because of, as you're saying, climate change, that there needs to be the ability to address that. And I'm not saying there should or shouldn't be, but I'm saying only, you can't do it if the statute does not allow it. And this statute, I would proffer, doesn't allow it. And that's really the point of, I think, Chief Justice Roberts' opinion. You can't take the word habitat and say it just means anywhere. You know, then we can say that habitat for a polar bear is the Florida Keys, because you could create the conditions necessary to support the polar bear in the Florida Keys. It sounds outlandish, but in fact, that's really what Chief Justice Roberts was getting at. And I think that's, you know, you could say that's why, because clearly the government chose not to put a limiting principle. They had to have known that question was going to come, but they intentionally chose not to say there's a limit to what can be habitat. And it very well may be for the reasons you're saying, because they want to use it in that way.
Mark, did you have any closing remarks to wrap up?
No, just thank you very much, Micah, and Federal Society for allowing me to speak about the case. Really, it's an honor always to speak to Federal Society members and others about any case that I'm involved with in any sort of way. This case was very special, and it's a really good decision. It's not that long, and I encourage everyone to read it, particularly if you're an administrative law practitioner, because of that second question. And then if you do environmental law and the ESA work, there's no question you need to read it for the Chief Justice Roberts' discussion of habitat. And then if you're a textualist, so if you're a fan of Scalia, I think you also will like Chief Justice Roberts' opinion because of the way he gets into grammar. So thank you very much, Micah.
The pleasure is all ours. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.